Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Alana Levine. If you know me, you know how obsessed I am with live performance. To me, nothing replaces being in a theater and the lights going down and the orchestra starts to play and that first moment of magic. And I know the way I feel about theater, some people feel about sports or opera or dance or comedy or food. And what if there was a place that you could go and find out which live events are going on near you? And then for a discount price, you can get off your couch, put down that clicker, and experience the magic that is live performance. Well, there is a place, goldstar.com. You just go to that website, you type in your city, and every amazing live event will be listed at discount prices. Theater, dance, comedy, film, food, concerts, sports. No more staying home. You are going to go out and build memories and experiences that expand your mind and heart through live performance with GoldStar.com. GoldStar is in 26 cities around the country. So go to GoldStar.com. Get out of your house and build memories that are magic for you and your family. Expand your mind, expand your hearts. Go see live performance by using GoldStar.com.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. Here's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-okay.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind the scenes photos, videos, and interviews and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Little known fact, when I asked my guest today if he felt successful, he said that he did. He said he is very aware that very few people get to do what he does. And he also told me that when he was 19, he had cancer. And when you get through something as life-altering as that, you spend your days focused, determined, and ambitious. Welcome, comedian, storyteller, Mike Birbiglia to the podcast.
A-OK. A-OK.
Hey, everyone. My guest today is the comedian, actor, author, and filmmaker, Mike Birbiglia. Mike is currently starring on Broadway in The New One, a solo show that he wrote and performs in. He also does his comedy shows all over the world. His most recent shows, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend and Thank God for Jokes, were both filmed live for Netflix. He wrote, directed, and starred in the film Sleepwalk With Me and Don't Think Twice. His book Sleepwalk With Me and Other Painfully True Stories was a New York Times bestseller. As an actor, Mike has appeared on Inside Amy Schumer, Girls, Broad City, Orange is the New Black, and Billions. On film, he appears in Trainwreck, The Fault in Our Stars, and Pop Star. He was honored with the Kurt Vonnegut Award for Humor. I am beyond honored to welcome Mike Birbiglia to my podcast.
It's a surreal thing because I listened to the Michael Ian Black episode of your show on the way on the subway here, and then I rolled straight into talking to you. So it was like a leap into reality from surreality.
I love him so much.
Oh, that was a tremendous interview. That maybe I've been a fan and friend of his for a while. Yeah. And that's my favorite interview I've heard of him.
We're done.
you broke down his multiple defenses.
Well,
which he has many of.
Yeah,
he's very self-deprecating to a point of, you were pointing out in the interview, that's not even self-deprecation. That's just sort of like inaccurately depicting what your his career reality. Is.
Yeah, exactly.
He's so self-deprecating. It is
exhausting.
It's exhausting, and you broke it.
I would be remiss if I did not begin this conversation telling you that I just saw the new one, which is your solo show that you wrote and perform in on Broadway.
Right around the corner.
Yeah. Well, 48th. That's why I have my booth here. I want you to go here, then take a little rest on the equity cot.
Yep, that's right.
Do your vocal warm-ups.
Equity cot. Yeah.
That's really inside. That's so inside Amy Schumer, what I
it
just said.
It is inside Amy Schumer, yeah.
That's where the equity cot is.
Yeah.
It's inside Amy Schumer.
Amy Schumer, I think, is coming to the show tonight, actually.
Wow. Yeah. I hope she doesn't have her baby during
the
show.
I know.
That would be so meta, wouldn't it? Like a show all about what it is to have a baby, and then someone has a baby in the audience.
I think that's the best case scenario for the show.
Yeah.
I think that that would be, it would peak. I couldn't perform it anymore. That would be peak the new one.
Right. That's right.
Because we have created some pregnancies.
During the show?
Supposedly. Post-show.
People are like, so you know what? If Mike did it.
I've been performing the show for 2 years on the road and developing it. And so I get a lot of emails and things. My last show, My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, was about how I got married despite not believing in the idea of marriage. And that created a lot of marriages. And then this one is about how I never want to have a kid. And then I have a kid. And that's created a lot of people at least saying to me, you know, at the stage door and things, they got pregnant after seeing the show. I don't know if it's true. They do say that. Maybe they're just trying to strike up a conversation.
Does that make you feel powerful?
No. But it does make me feel like I'm on the right track in terms of how personal I'm going and the intention of going personal.
Yeah.
Which is, if I go personal, the audience will go personal in their lives and sort of have open discussions of things that are very uncomfortable.
Which is what good comedy is. Discussing things that are, right?
Yeah, or at least the genre I'm in.
What? So I want to talk about that. So the new one is a one-man show, as I just said to my listeners, and you concur that that is what it is?
Yeah, I mean, it's a solo play. Some people call it a solo play. Some people refuse to call it that. Stand-up comedy. Some people go, it's a monologue. It's art. It's storytelling, but it's not a play. I don't know. Like, I don't care.
Right.
Like, it literally doesn't matter. My director and I talk about that all the time because it's a common question. We don't care. Like, we don't care what you call it. All we care about is what the experience is.
Well, it's interesting because you are a fabulously riveting, hilarious, poignant, mind-bending storyteller. That was my experience of you.
Oh,
I'd never seen you live before. So that was such a lucky thing to get to see you in person. Now I'm seeing you really live right now. The show is about a man who sort of felt like, as you said, I really don't see a reason for me. You weren't judging others to have a child, and sort of your journey around it. And the thing that is so incredible, first of all, I feel like my mother right now. I'm an actress. I've had to learn many lines in my life.
Yeah.
But the idea that you stood there effortlessly, seemingly effortlessly, telling us a story, and we're also able to kind of engage in the moment, like the street had been closed down, and you talked about that, sort of be also in both places at once. Is it hard for you to memorize things?
Yeah, but because I'm right, in this case, because I'm, like when I'm on Billions or Orange is the New Black, I find it very difficult.
You write your like lines on your hand and you peek.
Well, what I do is I basically try to replicate my writing process when I'm on those shows. I will write out the lines as though I wrote them, or I should say my character wrote them, and repeat them until I know them. But in this case, I spend so much time laboring over the words that I don't have to memorize them because I've spent hours and days and months and years on them.
Have you ever gone up or not known where you were when you perform?
Yeah, early on, more so, like Sleepwalk With Me, which was about 10 years ago, which Nathan Lane generously presented at the Bleecker Street Theater downtown.
I want to ask you, why did Nathan Lane?
Oh, why did he?
Yeah, like how do you know Nathan Lane?
He had my Secret Public Journal live comedy album, and because of that, in 2008, I was at Caroline's and he was in David Mamet's November down the street.
Right.
And someone as a gift knew that he liked my comedy, and so they got him tickets to the show. And he came to the show, and I was performing as stand-up, the Sleepwalk With Me show.
Okay.
And it was just a fluke, because it was, you know, a very theatrical show that would become a show. And he sent me a very nice note and a bottle of champagne the next night, and I was just in shock. I'd been a Nathan Lane fan since I was in high school, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sent him a note to his stage door, and then we met up. Jen and I, my wife and I, went to his play, November, which we loved, and then we went to dinner with him afterwards, and it was just like one of those friendships where you meet someone and it's like, oh, we've known each other our whole lives. Mm-hmm. It just felt like that. And then sort of several months later, we went to City Hall and we asked him to be the witness at our wedding at City Hall. And then a few years after that, he and his husband Devlin asked me and Jen to be their witnesses at City Hall. And
so, that's incredible.
Yeah, so that was sort of how it happened. It was this very strange thing where I told him about that Sleepwalk With Me, that what he had seen was part of an actual one-person show that I was hoping to mount off Broadway. And he's basically said, well, you know, I could put my name on it. I could present it, or like Meryl Streep did with Bridge and Tunnel, which was at the same theater, Bleecker Street. And I said, well, that would be incredible. And what was interesting, little known facts.
By the way, that's the new intro to every show now on. But anyway,
little
go on.
Little known fact, there's no paperwork for him presenting the show. You know, no, there was no money exchanged hand. It was just sort of a gift. It was like, here, take my name. Just, you know, whatever you want to do.
That's really incredible.
It really changed my life. Like meeting Nathan, like really changed. Like, three things happened that year that changed my life. One is I got married at City Hall. The other is I met Nathan Lane and he presented my show. And the third was I met Ira Glass and he put me on This American Life. So those three things entirely changed the trajectory
right.
of my life.
What year was that?
Career. 2008, 10 years ago.
Well, happy anniversary.
Thanks.
That's exciting.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, that's incredible. In a decade. Ira Glass is a very well-known producer and personality in the world of radio and other places. So you did not, because now if you Google your name, there's a million Ira Glass and Mike Birbiglia connections and things.
Yeah, we've
and
done
projects
a lot of things together. Yeah, he's a producer on the new one.
Yeah.
And he's produced both of my independent films that I directed.
It's funny because both those gentlemen, Nathan and Ira, by reputation, and obviously that's very different than what someone is really like
sure.
in real life, are intimidating people to the rest of us civilians, and not easy to get to know or get to or have a persona that's kind of more reserved.
I think that's fair.
So Ira came to see a show.
And it's hard for me to take that in because I know them as
warm
friends.
Yeah, they're family
friends.
Now. Yeah. No, they're not warm people at all.
No, but
you're
right.
Having
I think perhaps their reputation
of them.
Is that. Yeah,
right.
That could be.
So how, or just that there are some people who walk around with their hearts on their sleeves and give you all of themselves
sure.
on stage and off stage, and other people like,
I think
you
a
know,
lot of people come at those people.
Yeah. And,
those two people.
Yeah. But understandably, you're allowed to keep who you are for yourself private.
Sure.
And so this is with zero judgment. But first of all, that's just kind of amazing that they both were so attracted to you and your work and what you were putting out in the world. How did Ira see your work?
Ira saw it through Catherine Burns, who's the artistic director of The Moth.
Right.
Storytelling series and podcast radio show. I'd been involved with them. I had told my first story ever in 2003 with The Moth.
And was that like you called up and left your story in a message, or were you at an event
They had asked me to do an event at a comedy festival where they were doing shows and I was doing shows.
Okay.
And they said, they pulled in like Janine Garofalo and Lewis Black and myself and a bunch of other people. So then I worked with Catherine Burns and she coached me through telling a story that would later become the titular story of my girlfriend's boyfriend, about having a high school girlfriend who didn't told me not to tell anyone that she was my girlfriend. It's such an embarrassing, even saying it out loud is just like still a really embarrassing story. And she coached me through that. And then years later, I thought, I feel like a good fit would be This American Life. Like, I feel like that's where I'm sort of meant to be.
Yeah.
And so I asked if, I think of quite a few times.
Catherine Burns.
Yeah. I asked Catherine.
Can I be on?
No, can you put me in touch with This American Life? And then I was put in touch with Julie Snyder, who's senior producer there. And and sort of like months and months after they got the audio for Sleepwalk With Me, which is like a 13-minute version of Sleepwalk With Me, they said, maybe this might be on the show. And then apparently I found out later, like it was on the board for months and months. And
wow.
As like a possible. And then it ended up on there. And yeah, it's been strange.
When you say, because The Moth for so many of us was like our entree to listening to stories on
sure.
the radio.
Yeah, it's
like
great.
Our parents did it all the time. And then we started watching TV and going to movies. And then suddenly we were called back to this incredible, intimate, audible experience.
Yeah.
When you say she kind of coached you through it, I'm just curious, what does that mean? Are there like pointers or kind of ways, things you need to hit when you're doing a moth story?
Well,
or a story for the moth?
What Catherine was doing was what in my director, Seth Barish, and I would describe as dramaturgy,
okay.
which is if you think of a moth story as a 10-minute play, let's say, she's the dramaturg for the 10-minute play.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
So she helps you shape it and structure it in a way.
You have a rough story.
Right.
And, you know, she's teaching... Essentially, I mean, it just sounds so simple. It's like talking through, like, why is this the beginning? Why is this the end? Why is, you know, what's the logic of how it pulls through?
Right. So...
Or pulls the audience through.
Yeah. You're such a wonderful... storyteller and clearly in no small part because you're a wonderful writer. I mean, some people can improvise really well and you seem to be able to do all the things. When did you find like, oh, I have this voice. I have this ability to make people laugh. Like, were you the comedian in your family? Were you always aware that like I can make people laugh?
I was the youngest of four.
Mm-hmm. In Massachusetts?
Yeah, in central Massachusetts. I'm being very concise about that. Because
yeah, we don't want people to really know.
We don't want people... Well, no,
go
no,
to
no.
your house.
No, I don't want people to think I'm from Boston.
Oh, is that a thing?
Well, Boston's like fancier.
Oh, okay.
Central Mass is like...
You want your street cred
yeah,
to
yeah,
stay.
Yeah, it's like I grew up in the movie Beautiful Girls. You know, like of any movie that I've seen that
captures
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's
okay.
sort of like...
The rough and tumble.
Sort of blue-collar suburb in Massachusetts. That's where
yeah.
I grew up.
Okay.
And yeah, I feel like when people talk about Massachusetts, they're usually thinking like, oh, fancy Massachusetts.
But you did not grow up in a fancy family?
No, it wasn't fancy Massachusetts. Okay. My dad was a doctor.
That's fancy.
Right, but in a town where like everybody, all my friends' parents were like cops and teachers and
was that weird that your father
and military
was
service.
A doctor and not a blue-collar worker? Did you want to hide that?
I was just talking about that with my parents the other day because they were here for Christmas. They saw the show the other day, which was really
they
the
did.
First time they'd ever seen it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But I talked to my parents about that the other day. It's an odd thing when you're growing up in a town where you're
what the norm is.
Yeah,
and you're not the norm.
Yeah, what everybody's thing is. Yeah, you're not the norm. Yeah. It's a little bit it's
were
a little
there
bit
tracks
out of the
like who lived on which side of the tracks in your town?
Was it's so there funny.
Like...
It's funny you should say that. When I saw Lady Bird, we didn't have that formally. In Shrewsbury, like I think there was a part of town that I'm thinking of that if someone lived over there you'd go like, huh, how did they end up living there? Like that's you know, like
like in a good way or a
no,
bad way?
No, in a bad
things
way.
Things went very wrong.
No, in a bad way. Like you're like, no, like that's sort of like, wait, people live there?
Okay.
Like that kind of thing.
Okay.
Like that, there are houses over there?
Mm,
that kind of
yeah.
thing. And when I saw the movie Lady Bird, that moment where they talk about the wrong side of the tracks.
Or she goes to the friend's house
yeah.
and pretends that
it's
that's her house.
Yeah. I just cried so much. There's a few movies that make me cry so much. And one of them was Lady Bird, and it was the Wrong Side of the Tracks discussion. And the other one is a very Massachusetts movie, which is Spotlight. I couldn't stop crying. We were watching it at home, my wife and I, and I had to stop the movie because I was crying. I had cried for 15 minutes in the middle of the movie.
Did you grow up in a Catholic family?
Yeah, I was an altar boy. And I wasn't abused, but I had survivor guilt when I saw that movie that was so intense that I had to shut the movie off and then sort of gather myself.
Old enough to be aware when the story broke
no.
in the paper that, right, I mean, I guess you're, that was in the 80s? When did the Globe kind of run it? I don't remember.
When it ran exactly. No, I think it was in the 90s, okay. But I'm not sure.
Like, but it just I wasn't feel on like your it, radar.
I feel like it was maybe when I was in college, but late. I was in the college in the late 90s. I think that's around when it was. But
where did you go to school?
I went to a bunch of schools. I went to Shrewsbury Middle School, Shrewsbury High School, St. John's High School, all boys Catholic, and then St. Mark's High School. So I went to like a series of different schools.
And did you go to college in Boston also?
No, I went to Georgetown in D.C.
Okay, you got out.
Yeah, that was a big goal. I really wanted to get out.
So to answer
my
question.
Talking to my parents about that. Too.
We're going to have your parents here in a minute.
No, I know.
Would be exciting to have on.
They would not.
To hear their perspective. Well, I know from my reading and spending time with you on my computer that they would prefer us not to mention them at all or anything about your family.
My dad doesn't want any autobiographical.
I know. So we're going to move on from them because that is their right.
Okay.
That's their right.
Yeah, yeah.
But you were saying that you were the youngest and I was asking, like, did you entertain everybody?
Yeah, yeah. I think I sort of did. Yeah. And I think that's a common trait in the youngest of a big family is like you want to get people's attention. There's a part in my book, Sleepwalk With Me, where I say the first time I remember getting a laugh was when I was shitting in the backyard of my house. And it seemed logical, you know, sort of like, shit, you know, I have to poop and I'm here and the dogs poop outside.
How old were you?
Our dog poops. I think I was about 5 or so. Mm-hmm. Everyone started laughing and then it became a story in the neighborhood. And I feel like that's sort of a metaphor for my whole career. It's like, you know, you make mistakes.
And people laugh.
You make mistakes and people laugh. And then you go, let's do that again.
Well, you are now a guy who, I don't know how you define success, but to me, as someone who lives a life as an arts lover, you get to perform what you wrote in front of people. Get paid for it and feel appreciated. Some people even get married or have children because of these shows. It probably didn't start out like day one that this was the case.
Yeah.
So I really, really want to know like how this career grew and how did you think you were going to be an actor? Did you think you were going to be a comedian, a writer? Like what did you think when you went to college you were going to do?
When I went to college, I thought I was going to be, I had seen Stephen Wright live at the Cape Cod Melody Tent when I was 16. My brother Joe took me. And the moment I saw him, I thought, this is what I'm going to do.
Wow.
I had that epiphany moment where I was, it's kind of what you were describing, like you're laughing so hard, your cheeks hurt, your body hurts, your face hurts, your muscles hurt, like everything is hurting. And I just thought, oh, I think I can do that, which is the great sleight of hand of great comedy, I think, is the person is so good that you think you can do it too.
Right. At 16.
Yeah, at 16. And so I went home and I just started writing jokes in a notebook. And they're all just like Stephen Wright's like, kind of surreal observations. And they were terrible. But then a couple years later, I went to college. I went to Georgetown. I applied to Harvard. I tried to go to be in the Lampoon because that's the only.
So you were a great
writing.
Student. If you applied to Harvard, you had good scores and good grades.
Yeah, I don't think they gave any serious consideration to me though.
But you were aware what the
criteria
was.
Yeah, I was a good student.
You threw your hat in a ring.
I threw
not
my hat
feeling
in the
like
ring.
A crazy person. Like
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or slightly a crazy person.
Yeah, yeah. But
okay.
I had the delusion of thinking they'd want me as a comedy writer.
You're like, look at my application. Yeah, yeah. It's hilarious.
No, I swear to God.
Is that what your essay was about?
In my interview. Oh, yeah. I had all these like comedy writing, satire issues of the newspaper that I was the editor-in-chief of. And
from high school.
Yeah, yeah.
All your high schools.
Well, but primarily St. Mark's, which is where I was for 3 years. But no, I went to the, this is how delusional I was in high school about comedy. And maybe now in 2018, someone could do this and there would be some logic to it because comedy's popular now. But comedy wasn't popular then. I mean, it was popular, but it wasn't mass media, like pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now
well,
it's
there was
like,
no YouTube. I mean, it's
no,
just wasn't.
People now they go like, oh, maybe I'll be a comedian. People go, oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, there's money in that.
And right now it's, and back then it's like, I'm going to be a comedian. It's like, no, you're not. Like, no one thought you could be a comedian.
Five people are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No one thought. And so I went to the interview for Harvard Lampoon. And I was like, I pulled out all of these satire issues of the newspaper and all this comedy writing, which is probably pretty good for a high school student. I don't know. It was probably all right. And then, and I was like, this is what I want to do. And I want to write for the Lampoon. And the woman who was a lawyer said, is there any other reason you want to go to Harvard? And I said, no. And that was the end of the
interview.
Guess
who didn't go to Harvard? At Georgetown, however, they were like, that sounds great.
But then
we have plenty of lawyers here.
But then the Lampoon inducted me as an honorary member recently.
Isn't that the best?
Yeah, it was cool.
Isn't that the best without having to do any of that work
there?
Super cool. You could just go. It was in Boston. You did have to go to Boston.
It was in Cambridge.
For
yeah.
You know, I was talking to Jack, who you met when you first came in,
yeah.
who's engineering this session for us, who's a big fan of yours, as is anyone I've talked to, because I can't stop talking about you since I saw your show. I feel like many of my friends who grew up wanting to do comedy or are doing comedy at some point auditioned like SNL. SNL
was
like a touchstone for them.
For
they
sure.
grew up watching SNL.
Yeah.
Their parents let them stay up and watch SNL. So is there a part of you going, I'm just going to go to New York and audition for SNL?
Yeah, certainly. Our graduation week of high school, our teaching advisor gave a speech where he said what everyone in my class, which was like 80 people, one by one, he said what we were going to be.
Right.
And he said, Mike Birbiglia is going to be on Saturday Night Live. And it really crushed this other guy who was in my class who was an impressionist.
His name was Seth.
That
Seth
would be some,
was like, listen
that would be
to
some
me.
Kind of story.
I'll show him all.
That's
well,
good.
Everyone, I mean, Newton, you know, seven people I know, like Krasinski.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
there's
Mindy
a lot.
Mindy Kaling,
yes,
all those folks,
and
yeah.
so many. BJ Novak. Like, there are a lot of funny
But then I made
people.
A movie about Saturday Night Live. And then... And that's been sort of a funny, like, I have a funny sort of tangential relationship with Saturday Night Live because I made this movie.
Right.
Sort of in a, it's not about Saturday Night Live.
So
but
you
it's,
never
it's
auditioned
a,
for
don't
Saturday
think twice,
Night Live.
It's sort of has a Saturday Night Live doppelganger
right.
called Weekend Live.
Right. Which is hilarious.
Thanks.
Did you ever audition for SNL?
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah. What happened was I was past... My stand-up career, in an attempt to become a comedy writer, I had to perform my own writing because there was no one to perform it.
Why not? Where were the people?
I was at Georgetown. Nobody was performing
Funny.
Stand-up comedy. Well,
okay.
they were. I was in an improv group,
okay.
but no one
That's
wanted to
do.
Be a solo performer, and I had all these observations, right? So it's like, who's going to perform? I guess I am. You know, which is what a lot of stand-up comedians are. And Seth Meyers is that, by the way. Seth Meyers is that. Woody Allen is that. Like, there's a lot of comedy writers who, at a certain point, they were just like, no, you say it like this.
Mm-hmm. Let me do it.
Yeah,
let me move over.
Let me do it. And that, yeah. I'm that genre.
So that's how it started. So you've kind of answered my question. You did go to Georgetown, and you joined an improv group.
Yeah, I auditioned for the improv group because they didn't have a sketch comedy group
because
I was trying to write sketch comedy. And so then I was in the improv group because that's what was there. And I was actually cast by my friend Chris Fosdick, who's not in show business, but is still a good friend. And James Murray was the assistant director who now is the star of Impractical Jokers on True TV, which is a great show. And then I went on, after he left, I went on to cast Nick Kroll. And then he was in my group. And then after I graduated, a year later, he cast John Mulaney.
I was going to ask sort of who the beginning, how your community got started, or who the first people.
Yeah, the first ones are James Murray and Chris Bozek.
And then when you finished at Georgetown, did you come to New York?
Yeah, I mean, it came down to, do I go to Chicago to do improv, or do I go to New York to do stand-up? Because to me, those were the hubs of the places that I was interested in. And New York was where my sister Gina lived, and so I lived on her couch for a little bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And so when you first got here, you graduate from college with a degree in...
English writing, yeah.
And are you like, okay, I'm going to get a job as a teacher, or I'm going to try to be a journalist, and I'll do comedy on the side, or were you full in?
Yeah, it was sort of like, I'd been working the door at the Washington, D.C. Improv Comedy Club.
And did you get to go on there?
Sometimes, yeah. By the time I graduated, I was like opening for like Brian Regan and Margaret Cho and Kathleen Madigan and a lot of people who I really admire and I learned a lot from.
So if I were at one of those shows and had the pleasure of seeing you open for them.
At the time, it would not have been a pleasure.
The in-pleasure. What were you talking about then? What was the beginning of...
Well, I sort of depict it in my movie Sleepwalk With Me, where like early versions of my stuff were just like... observational, just like I would hate to be a stick insect, because if all the other insects are always bumping into you because they don't know you're there, and you got to be like, watch it. And you're like, yeah, you look like a stick. And you're like, yeah, but I have eyes. And they're like, yeah, they were closed. And so they're like really silly. Like there's a lot of like really silly stuff like that.
But like, do you remember? You're young, so it's not that long ago. But like, where did that come from?
That's sort of Stephen Wright through my own lens. Like to me, that was...
Stephen Wright meets a stick at Insect.
Well, it's just that. Well, or somewhere between Stephen Wright and sort of Seinfeld and like, just sort of like, yeah, just observing things and picking them apart and becoming, I think observational comedy is like, intentionally not seeing the forest from the trees. Mm-hmm. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's this sort of like, and that's what my personality is.
In real life.
Yeah, I'm obsessive. Uh-huh. And my obsessiveness sometimes leads to observations that are irrational, but humorously irrational.
So have you been
walking around?
And
then at a certain point, I tipped into, okay, let's have that be about myself.
Right.
And so that's how I landed where I am.
And that's worked great for you.
Yeah.
So starting even then, were you walking around with like a little pad?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
You were just always writing stuff down. And
definitely.
Do you still do that?
Yeah. Yeah. Lately I've been doing it on like my on my phone on Evernote, mm-hmm. which is just like a notes program. But yeah, I think that's sort of the key. If you're a writer, like if you're listening to this and you're an aspiring writer, I think that's the key to everything. Because it's like, there's these things called mind writing slogans. Like if you write, when I was writing my first book, I'm writing another book now.
Your second.
Yeah, yeah. But my second in training. But I was writing my book, Elna Baker, who's a producer on This American Life, a great writer. She said, you should put these mind writing slogans up, and they're from all different writers, and they're just these little quotes. And they're really
like
good.
A Pinterest board of
they really are. They're kind of like the one, there's like an Ezra Pound one that's like, only emotion endures. It's three words, only emotion endures. And I love, like, I had that on my wall for a long time. And, there's an Allen Ginsberg one that's like, write what is vivid to you. And that's why I think like jotting things in a notebook is crucial, because vividness only occurs really in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And if you capture it and you write it down, you'll have it later. But if you don't capture it in that moment, later you'll only really have the sort of the fuzzy version of
it. Right, like a fuzzy memory.
Yeah, it's not vivid.
Well, it's right, and it's not of the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think that writing the notes thing is really crucial, which is why I think it's really hard to live with a writer, which is my wife is a poet, so the two of us are
miserable.
A real pair. Well, because we're both like writing in our notebooks all the time.
Talk to me.
Yeah,
look
exactly.
Up. You're little, you have a daughter, right?
Yeah, she's three and a half.
Well, she's probably got her little notebook.
Yeah, exactly. She does.
All,
oh, yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. So when was the first like little bit of sunlight that came into like your comedian cave of, oh, I might find a bunch of people who like what I do.
There was it was my improv group in college.
Mm-hmm.
because I was, before that, I really didn't connect with my fellow peers at Georgetown for whatever reason. It's sort of a conservative school, and
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
In a conservative place.
In a conservative place. And I don't know, it was sort of very serious. And then I met these really silly goofball, like carnival type improvisers. And I just thought, these guys are great. Like, this is my dream come true. That
was
sort of
the
happiest
teacher?
I've ever.
Was there like a great person leading it who like you're
this
like,
guy Chris Fosdick, who didn't end up being an improviser. It was funny, I was talking to Mike Myers, the great actor and sketch comedian, came to the show the other night.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I were talking about Don't Think Twice, because he said that he was like, you made this movie that's like about my life.
Yeah.
He's like,
that's nice.
Yeah, it was really nice. And then I go, yeah, did you have this thing where like this in my group, like there's the Chris Fosdick was the patriarch of the whole thing. And he didn't stay in show business, and he was the best.
Uh-huh.
And Mike Myers just said, we had that. There's all these people who are great, and for whatever reason, they didn't stay in. And it's, I think Mike Myers described it as like, there's a thing that keeps people in it that is intangible, and nobody knows why mm-hmm. they stay in, and it's sort of a certain type of madness, and it's like, and those are the people who stick around and sort of make it, and it's a bizarre alchemy that I think almost no one understands, in even in show business.
But how did you know, when you come from a family of doctors and you're interested in, I'm going to call it stand-up, but it's, so as we said earlier, like to put a word or a term
yeah.
on what you do is, it doesn't really matter, but to perform and make people laugh, you didn't have an in through your family into this business. Like, you really came into it completely unattended.
Yeah,
so,
I was lucky. Well, I had two lucky things in my family, yeah. which were flukes. They're not nepotism, but they were good. They were happy accidents, which is my brother Joe, for whatever reason, got into writing satire when he was like a sophomore or junior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in like eighth grade or seventh grade. And so I was at that very impressionable age where I was like, well, that's the cool thing to do, is
right.
to write comedy. And so I started writing comedy. It was like a seventh and eighth grade.
So you loved your brother.
So then, yeah. Yeah. And my brother works with me now, and he collaborates with me on a lot of projects and produces a lot of stuff that I do. And so there's that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's my brother who
like
just
a mentor
way. Just randomly like loves comedy as a high school student. And then the other happy accident was that my sister Gina, who's 11 years older than me, was working in television production in Chicago at like some talk, like at Oprah Winfrey and some other talk shows.
Not like Oprah, but at Oprah.
But that was one of the places she worked. And then when she moved to New York, she worked at Lifetime Television for Women. And then, I don't know if it's still called that.
Mm.
It's still called that?
I don't know.
And then...
is there still Lifetime?
I don't know.
We're going to say yes and yes.
Sure, yes, there is. And then she ended up being an assistant at HBO in the comedy department. But so she would just go see comedy shows for free a lot. And then when I would come to New York, she would take me to comedy shows for free. So when I was like in high school and college, like I would go to the Comic Strip, or I would go to Luna Lounge, which is now closed, but it was a big scene at the time. That Luna Lounge was the scene that yielded Sarah Silverman and Mark Maron and Todd Barry and Louis C.K. and all these people who went from being sort of underground comedians to being main. The underground comedians of the 90s ended up being sort of the mainstream popular comedians of the 2000s. So in the 90s, my sister sort of inadvertently educated me on what was like a hip scene
right.
In comedy, which none of us knew. She didn't know. I didn't know. None of us knew that that would end up being the pop art form, which comedy is now in 2018. Right. Nobody knew in the 90s.
And you're learning these it lineups and absorbing
were like,
it.
These lineups would be like Zach Galifianakis and Dimitri Martin and, you know, all these people. It's just, the lineups from that era are wild because it really is like the popular comedy of today.
So you start performing in New York. How did you get a foot in the door to perform on a stage in New York once you left your improv company and now you're here?
It was very rigorous. It was, I was working the door at the Washington, D.C. Improv, mm-hmm. and the final week before graduating, I was opening for Brian Regan. And Brian Regan's feature act was his brother, the comedian Dennis Regan, who's hilarious as well. And I told them I was moving to New York. And Dennis Regan said, oh, if you're moving to New York, I'll call the club owners and tell them you're coming.
That's so awfully nice.
So he calls three club owners. He calls the Comedy Cellar. He calls Gotham Comedy Club. And he calls the Comic Strip. And the one of those that took him up on the offer to see me was the Comic Strip. So I performed at the Comic Strip for this, in front of this guy named Lucian Hold, who's
like,
now
passed
away.
Like, do you audition
away.
Just for
yeah.
him?
Yeah.
Okay.
In an audience.
Okay.
In front of an audience.
But that's how you try out.
Yep. And he said, he sort of was like, well, you're not ready, but he saw my potential. And then I kept auditioning. And then I think on my like third audition there, which was 6 months after I moved to New York, he started letting me perform. And then he became my personal manager until he passed away a few years later.
Wow. And does he start booking you in places outside of New York? And is that when he sort of begins?
Yes. Yeah, so he sort of helped put me in. He did. He helped me put me in touch with a college booking agent whose name is Kate McGill. And she started booking me at literally hundreds of colleges across the country, which is how I was able to. A lot of times people say to me, like, how'd you do long sets? Like,
yeah.
I can only do 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, me too. Except I got booked at these colleges and then you'd be in cafeterias or rooms, like multi-purpose rooms where 20 people show up. But you're booked to perform for an hour.
And you get to
There's
work
no other
it
comedian.
Out. Yeah.
And so you're just like, well, you have to fill an hour. It's not,
but
you,
that is
it's
so
not do you
different.
Get to fill an hour. It's
you
like,
have to.
You have to. You're in River Falls, Wisconsin. Like, there's no other entertainer there.
So is that how you go from jokes to stories?
Yeah, I think that that's a lot of it. I would string together joke after joke after joke after joke. And I, at one point, this great, the late great comedian, John Panette, who I opened for a handful of times, he said, I opened for him once at Caroline's, which was actually around the corner from here and one of the places that put me on stage very first, right after the Comic Strip. And he said, you know, your jokes are good, but you gotta put it together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was his advice. And he was a storyteller. And so that was one of the times that I early on I just started putting long chunks together and that's sort of what I do now. Except I build it the other way, which is I build from the story and then I fill the story with jokes so that the audience never, ideally, the audience doesn't lose interest. Some person who hates me is listening going, I lost interest.
I did. I turned this. They're not listening because they turned off 20 minutes ago. Don't worry. So you also had the great coincidence of having a lot of crazy things happen to you. You had cancer when you were 19 years old.
Yeah.
You're in remission.
Yep.
You sleepwalk and fall out of windows and hurt yourself.
I had that happen once.
Right?
I jumped through a window. Yeah.
Right. You wanted to have a kid. There were a lot of barriers in your way for having a kid. So you have the great fortune of having tremendous, both hilarious, painful experiences that you have the talent to put down and write down. And then somehow, what I just have to say about experiencing you, and I hope you'll come back when you're not in a show and we have more time, because I don't want to keep you from doing what you need to do. Okay. Most people don't have bladder cancer at 19, and most people, you know, don't have a sleeping disorder.
Yeah.
Some do. It's why it's so, it resonates because enough people have heard of it or
sure,
have sleeping issues, just not as dramatic. But I just have to say, Mike, that like your ability to, I would dare say that even if you are not interested in having children ever, for real, or marriage or any of the things that you've struggled with in your own deciding process, decision-making process, it's so beyond what you're talking about. It resonates on so many levels beyond the obvious literal, this is a man who didn't want to have a kid and now he has a kid. And that's what's so incredible about being in your audience, that you could be, you're so relatable.
Thanks.
It's just such a unique gift.
Well, part of it is like, I have to give credit to Seth Barish, who's my director mm-hmm. and dramaturg, and Ira Glass, my producer. Seth and I always talk about like what is the show about for people who would never want to have a kid,
mm-hmm.
don't have a kid, couldn't care less about having a kid. And I think that what the show is about is resistance to change and fear. And so like, here's this guy who happens to be me, who's
all of us.
Who's all of us.
Yeah.
Who fiercely doesn't want to do these things to the point where he lays out this elaborate argument for why no one should ever want to do these things. And then at the end, he does the thing. And the journey from here to there is hopefully something that makes people feel like they're seen.
The stories, they
themselves are.
That we end up seeing on stage, were those the ones that were easy to write? Or are they all equal struggle and equal joy? Or
the hardest one, like, without giving it away, is like the red light district story is mm-hmm. the hardest one to put on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly like hard to put like in front of my parents, for mm-hmm. God's sakes. But and even like things that, you know, there's a few reviews. We've been very fortunate with the reviews, but like there was like a review or two where people take issue with certain things that I say that are like very edgy about how I've felt about the idea of being a parent. They're very like, wait, you're saying you can't say that. You're not allowed to say that, you mm-hmm. know? And those are hard
mm-hmm.
to say
mm-hmm.
because they're things that they're the deep, dark thoughts that you don't want to say, but that I think theater is about. And so I have to insist on saying them, even if people are going to criticize me and say, you can't have that deep, dark thought. I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, that's why I go to the theater.
Yeah.
I go to the theater to hear the things that no one like will say. And I don't know. It's weird because I'm an autobiographical solo performer. I think I'm held to a different standard than when people see a play based on fictional characters.
Right.
So like, my favorite play in the last couple of years was Yerma, which is at the Armory, and it was about these two characters struggling with fertility, this wife and husband that are really struggling to have a child, and they say these things to each other that are so wicked and mm-hmm. wild, and like, and the audience, I mean, there's a major catharsis in the audience is hearing these characters say these things that are like, you can't say that.
Listen, when Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was first on stage, people couldn't believe that a playwright would write a husband and wife talking to each other that yeah. way. I mean, every decade there's some play that people are like, that is verboten, and how would anyone yeah. write that down, say it out loud, and have us watch it?
Yeah, and then like, so that's been a difficult thing with performing this show is there's an outpouring of people who feel a catharsis from it, but then there's also like a few people who are mostly outliers who are just like, no, that's too far.
Mm.
You went one step too far.
Yeah.
And that's their experience. I can't take that away from them. I'm not for them.
Right.
What I did is not for you. And I guess it's not a fit. I guess you won't be at the next show.
Right.
But like, it's definitely what me and my director are going for.
Well, it sounds like you can live with that.
I think I can live
with
that.
You can live with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you going to film the new one for people who don't have the luxury of being in New York City? Will they get to see it on their television?
I think we will film it. I think we're going to tour it, so I don't think it'll be available for a couple of years. But I think eventually people will be able to see it.
Well, I just want to say the pleasure of watching all of your comedy specials on television, and people can listen to your comedy and all your comedy albums and read your books and see your movies. I discovered you later in life. I feel so lucky that I'm just discovering you, because I get to go back and watch all these things and experience them for the first time.
Wow. I feel the same way about the podcast. Well, like you broke Michael Ian Black, and now I'm like, who else did you break?
Well, there are many. There
did
are
you
many
break
people
Mike, that, Matthew Broderick too?
Matthew Broderick is huddled in a corner.
Is he?
Crying. yeah. I like to think that I break them and then I bring them back.
Yeah.
Better than they were before.
Breaking the best that you can.
Mike, thank you for being on Little Known Facts.
Thank you so much.
I really need you to come back, and I need 7 more hours with you.
I will return.
Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Have a great show tonight.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. Do you know there are over 120 episodes of Little Known Facts with Alana Levine at this point? So if you love this one, but you're a new listener, go back to the beginning and catch up. I promise you, every episode will shed a light on an artist that inspires you in a whole new way. It is such a pleasure to make this podcast for you, and I hope if you love listening as much as I love making it, that you'll head over to my website, littleknownfactspodcast.com. There's a donation page, and truly, any donation, large or small, makes such a huge impact on my being able to make over 100 more episodes for you guys. So I really, really appreciate it. I record this podcast at the Hangar Studios in New York City. If you ever are interested in making your own podcast or any kind of recording, go to thehangarstudios.com and get more information on how they make the magic happen. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.